themes. We've looked at the introduction, and we've looked at Paul's theme, if you like, his text for Romans, verses 16 and 17. We saw that Paul was proud of the gospel because he understood it, and he understood how it solved the problems of the human race. That the problems of the human race don't have to do with economics, they don't have to do with education, they don't have to do with philosophy, they have to do with man's relationship with God. So we move now at the beginning of this section, beginning at verse 18 in chapter 1, the doctrinal exposition, and this takes us through to the end of chapter 8. Now this first section of the doctrinal exposition goes down to chapter 3 and verse 20, where Paul is dealing with the subject of sin and retribution, and he is giving a diagnosis of the universal need of the human race for salvation. He said in verse 16 and 17, he's not ashamed of the gospel, it is the power of God for salvation. Well, why do people need salvation? And then he says at the end of verse 17, he who through faith is righteous shall live. Well, why is it only those who are righteous through faith? What about the others? What about those that try their best? Why aren't they included? Why are they among the ones who will live? And so Paul is now going to explain to us why people need salvation. And so we have this section through to chapter 3, verse 20, in which he explains the reasons for this. And this falls into four, possibly three sections. It really depends on how we regard the first half of chapter 2. Firstly, the pagan world is condemned. That's verse 18 of chapter 1 to the end of the chapter. Then the moralist is condemned, chapter 2, verses 1 to 16. Then the Jews are condemned, chapter 2, verse 17 to chapter 3, verse 8. And there is some dispute as to whether, in fact, the whole of chapter 2 is about the Jew, or whether it is indeed talking about Gentile moralists. And then finally, the last section is a summary and conclusion of all Paul's arguments in chapter 3, verses 9 to 20. And what he's concluding there is that all men, everywhere, without exception, are condemned. Well, in this first section, the rest of chapter 1 from verse 18, Paul is dealing with the pagan world, with those around him. He's writing this from Corinth, and he could see all around him the consequences of an ungodly and a pagan world. He's working through, and he's trying to get from the point where people will agree totally with him, because he goes through and he says the things that he does, and people read that and say, this is disgusting. Well, he's aiming to get from there to cover all men, whether moral or religious, in order to show that they are in need of salvation. Now, right at the beginning, we have a problem, because we have a phrase here, the wrath of God is revealed. What is the wrath of God? You talk to a lot of people, you talk to a lot of ministers of churches, professors in theological colleges, and they will say, the wrath of God, don't have any of that concept of God being angry with people. That's the old-fashioned God. That's the God of the Puritans and hellfire preachers of the past. Do away with that idea. God isn't like that at all. God's a nice guy who's like me, and he gets on with everybody, and God would never be angry with anybody. So therefore, to speak about the wrath of God in that sense is entirely wrong. What they see the wrath of God as being is no more than cause and effect. You stick your finger in the fire and your finger gets burnt. So it's a cause and effect relationship. You put your finger into an electricity socket and you get electrocuted. But there's nothing personal about it. It's not that God is there saying that's wrong and punishing you for it. It is much more that it's a cause and effect, that we're in the universe that we are, and that if you do things, they have consequences. And so these consequences are the wrath of God. But there's nothing personal about it. God himself isn't angry. It's merely the consequence of doing certain things. However, if you look at the Bible and you read the scriptures, find out what the scriptures actually teach, you find out that the wrath of God is not that at all. The wrath of God is God's supernatural intervention into the world as an expression of his anger against sin. And it demonstrates his anger. And it's what you would expect from a God who is holy and who is righteous and who has established his law and communicated that to men, and his anger is against them because they rebel against God and against his law, do what they think is right in their own eyes. This is offensive to God, and God is justly angry. Now, it's important to note here that when Paul speaks about the wrath of God, he is not saying it in the sense that is commonly understood. So when you talk to people about the wrath of God, immediately they think, oh, you mean when I do something wrong, lightning is going to fall from heaven and consume me. And that's the way people think. They think the wrath of God is fire falling from heaven, as it did on Sodom and Gomorrah. And every time you talk about the wrath of God, they think in those terms. Paul tells us here that it's much broader than that. Because note what he says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men. Not the wrath of God is going to be revealed. Paul is not here talking about the day of judgment. He is talking about the very time of which he's writing. And he is not saying that all around him fire is falling from heaven and consuming sinners. He's saying the wrath of God is revealed against these people in the ways in which he is going on to describe. Now, we can look at the wrath of God in a number of other ways. We'll quickly consider this. Back in Genesis chapter 6, you find that God was angry with the early human race because of their sin. In Genesis 6 verse 1, when men began to multiply on the face of the ground, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair, and they took to wife such as they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide with man forever, for he is flesh, but his days shall be 120 years. Verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the ground, man and beast, and creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So here, man is wicked and rebels against God, and God is angry with them because of that sin, and his judgment falls upon them, and his wrath is revealed in the falling of that judgment. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 29, we could read from here to the end of the chapter. I said to you, do not be in dread or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you will fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes and in the wilderness, where you have seen how the Lord your God bore you, as a man bears his son, in all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet, in spite of his word, you did not believe the Lord your God, who went before you in the way to seek you out a place to pitch your tents, in fire by night, to show you by what way you should go, and in the cloud by day. And the Lord heard your words and was angered, and he swore, not one of these men of this evil generation shall see the good land which I swore to give to your fathers, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh. He shall see it, and to him and to his children I will give the land upon which he has trodden, because he has wholly followed the Lord. The Lord was angry with me on your account, this is Moses speaking, and said, you shall not go in there. Joshua the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall enter. Encourage him, that he shall cause Israel to inherit it. But moreover, your little ones, who you said would become a prey, and your children, who this day have no knowledge of good and evil, shall go in there, and to them I will give it, and they shall possess it. But as for you, turn and journey into the wilderness, in the direction of the Red Sea. So because of rebellion by the people of Israel, God said, right, I am angry with you, I will manifest my wrath upon you by causing you to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, until all the generation that was rebellious dies, and then I'll take in your children. They will be the ones to inherit it. Then we have present aspects of the wrath of God in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 5. be sure of this, that no fornicator or impure man or one who is covetous, that is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words. It is because of these things that the wrath of God comes, present tense, upon the sons of disobedience. And we also have a reference in Romans 13 to the governing authorities of the land being instruments of the wrath of God. Romans 13 verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. And you have no fear of him who is in authority, and do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. If you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. He is the servant of God to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore one must be subject not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. So here is temporal punishment being imposed upon people by the state as an instrument, albeit unwittingly, of God's anger against sin. And it's in Romans 1 verse 18 that we are looking at that the term is used in the present tense sense. So it's what happens here now in this world that Paul is speaking about. There is, of course, a future aspect to the wrath in verse 5. By your hard and impenitent heart, he says, you are storing up wrath for yourself on the day of wrath, when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. And there are many other references that you can look at about the future judgment and God's anger being poured out. Let me just list a few. 1 Thessalonians 5:9, Revelation 6 verses 16 and 17, 2 Thessalonians 1 verses 5 to 12, and Luke chapter 12 verses 4 and 5. And you can read through the Gospel of Matthew and note how often Jesus speaks about the judgment that is to come upon sinners. But what we find here, back in Romans 1, is that God's anger is being revealed today in the world. What we need to ask is, why is God angry with these people? Now, Paul is not here speaking about Jews. He's not speaking about people that have got the Bible. He's not speaking about people that have had missionaries going to them. He's talking about total unbelievers with no knowledge of the scriptures at all. Why is God angry with these people? Well, the answer is, all men, without exception, have some knowledge of God through general revelation, revelation that is common to all men. So no man can say on the day of judgment, you didn't give me a Bible, you didn't send me a missionary. God will say, but I revealed myself to you clearly in a way that you could not deny, even though you did. And what Paul is speaking about here is a revelation from God in the creation around us and our consciences within, because we're made in the image and likeness of God, and it's impossible not to look in the mirror and see who is God's creation and to reflect upon that internally in our hearts. You look through the scriptures right from the beginning, it says that we were made in the image and likeness of God. In James, James says one of the reasons why we should not be abusive to each other is because we are made in the image of God. And to abuse one another, then we are abusing God. And Paul makes the point in Acts chapter 17, verse 28, he says, your poets have said, we are indeed the offspring of God. Well, if we're God's offspring, how can God be a lump of stone or wood or gold? Absurd. But being God's offspring, this is how we should respond, and men should be able to reason this way and reflect upon this and come to these conclusions. The sad thing is that people don't. But what we find here is that God is angry because, verse 19, what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. Now, it's very important to fix that verse very clearly in the mind. When someone says, I'm an atheist, you know, because God has told us there, that they are telling a lie. When someone says, there is no God, what they're saying is, I am denying what is true, because God has plainly revealed it. is beyond number, I would imagine, the number of people who have said, there is no God, there's no evidence for God. If there's a God, why doesn't God come down now and reveal himself to me? Which shows them to be just ever so slightly arrogant and proud. But the answer to that question is simple, it's because God has already revealed himself to you. God has made it plain to them. God has shown it to them. And so the consequence is that we should not be surprised to find the psalmist writing words like these in Psalm 19. Where David speaks about the wonder of creation. And this is the way all men should reflect as they look at the world around them. They should respond in this sort of way. The heavens are telling the glory of God. The firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes out to all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. What the psalmist is saying is that there is non-verbal communication. So you can look at your husband or your wife, and you can tell by the way they wave their hands or by the way they move their eyes or whatever, without them uttering a word, you know exactly what they mean. You know what they're thinking. Non-verbal communication. And it's the same with God. God has revealed himself and communicated, not by speaking to people with words, but by speaking through the creation around. I am reminded of a particular American artist, a man by the name of Jackson Pollock. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his works of art. I'm sure they fetch millions of pounds if they were auctioned today. What they consist of is lots and lots of spots, and they are entirely random. And what he did sometimes was to take a paint pot and suspend it from the ceiling with a bit of string, and he'd make a hole at the bottom of the paint pot, and he'd swing the paint pot backwards and forwards over the canvas, and he'd just swing away and produce all these spots. Why on earth he got any credit for producing this, I can't possibly understand. But this is how he produces art. You can go to art galleries and there's Jackson Pollock. Oh, this great artist, look at what this is communicating. What it's communicating is everything is random. All happened by chance. And yet you look out of the window, you can look at a tree. Did that tree get there entirely by chance? The intricate design, the beauty of it, is that entirely by chance? This is what people like Jackson Pollock were trying to communicate. Life is meaningless, everything is random. And yet we know it isn't. It's as sensible to say that the world came about by chance as it is to say that the Mona Lisa was the product of an explosion in a paint factory. It's absurd. And when you hear these people saying, oh, everything happened by chance, it's all by evolution, it's the nonsense. It shows that they are not, it's not because of the evidence that they're saying these things, it's because of wicked unbelief. God has revealed himself. God has spoken through these things. And so therefore, we need to remember also the word of David in Psalm 14. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none that does good. So we see the wickedness of the human heart in looking out and saying, chance. When God made it, God sustains it, God made us and he sustains us. One day God will judge us. Now God has revealed himself more clearly and more directly through the Lord Jesus Christ and through the scriptures. And so that gives those who have the scriptures, those who have heard missionaries and preachers of the gospel, it gives them greater privileges. And also with the greater privileges come greater responsibilities. But all men, everywhere, without exception, have this knowledge of God. I mentioned Acts 17 already. Let's just refer back to it once more. And Paul follows through this argument to show them the folly of what the Athenians were doing with their idolatry. In Acts 17, and verse 22. Paul, standing in the middle of the Areopagus, said, men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. But as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription: to an unknown God, just to be on the safe side. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you: the God who made the world. You hear people saying you should never talk about creation when you're preaching the gospel. Called it. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all men life and breath and everything. And he made from one every nation of men to live on the face of the earth, God's in control of history, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their habitation, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after him and find him. Yet he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. Even some of your poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the deity is like gold or silver or stone, a representation by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And this he has given assurance to all men by raising him from the dead. So there is this communication from God through the creation and through man's soul within, speaking to him about the creator who made him and sustains him. And yet men, in spite of this, deny it. But Paul says here in Romans 1:20, how has God revealed himself ever since the creation of the world? His invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. So no man can ever say, I didn't have enough information. God has provided sufficient information for all men to know that there is a God and to know certain things about him. And Paul tells us some of the things about him. Ever since the creation, his invisible nature. God is invisible. You can't see him. His eternal power and Godhead. But if God made the world, and the more we learn about the world is amazing, and then we get telescopes and start looking at the universe, we realise that God made this as well, and we can't work out just where the universe ends. Does the universe end or doesn't it? I remember when I was about 5 having nightmares dreaming about this. How big is the universe? Well, it must come to an end sometime. Well, how will it come to an end? Well, I suppose there's a brick wall. But what is the size of a brick wall? And so I have nightmares. And I remember a friend of mine telling me once that there are various theories, one of which is that the universe is finite but doesn't have any boundaries. And there's another one that the universe is infinite but does have boundaries. I have problems with that one. But we reflect on these things. God has made all this. God must be immensely powerful if God can create this universe in the way that it is. And Paul says these things have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. It is clear. It is unequivocal. It's not a question of, well, some people believe and some don't. Some people feel there's enough evidence and some don't. The evidence is overwhelming. And it's not a matter of intellect. It's not a matter of intellectual problems, why people don't believe in God. The problem is a moral and a knowledge of God, because they don't like the consequences. Verse 21, although they knew God, they did not honour him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking. Their senseless minds were darkened, claiming to be wise, they became fools. Just what David had said 1,000 years before. And exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, or birds, or animals, or reptiles. The knowledge that God has given to us is clear. Therefore it is rational. So therefore to reject it is irrational. And it is foolish. People receive all the benefits that God has to give them, and yet they reject God. God provides them with life and health and everything. The fact that we take another breath, our hearts take another beat, the fact that we have food and clothing and all these other things is all thanks to God. Are we grateful to him? The majority of people are not. They dishonour God. They despise God. And they think that in doing this they're being clever. How often have you heard people on the radio saying, oh, anyone that believes in God, they really must be away with the fairies. it shows their dishonor of God. They, in fact, are the ones who are foolish, not those who believe. It's important to recognize from what Paul says here, it is possible to be highly intelligent, to have an IQ of, say, 300, to be a professor with a string of degrees after your name. But if you deny the existence of God, you are a fool. As someone who has a normal IQ and says there is no God is a fool. So is someone with an IQ of 300. So you can be a silly fool, or you can be a clever fool, but a fool nonetheless if you deny the existence of God. And what happens when people reject the knowledge of God? Their minds become futile, darkened, and they exchange the glory of God for other things. And we've seen that down through the centuries, down through the millennia. People have set up idols, all manner of weird and wonderful idols. People have idols today. Whether it be a lump of wood or stone, and there are such people who bow down to lumps of wood and stone. The Hindus, a good devout Hindu, will have their shrine in their home, and they'll probably have several images. Ganesh, who was an elephant, seems to be very popular. You remember, was it last year? That Ganesh was supposed to start drinking milk. And they say, oh, how wonderful is this? This is a miracle. Well, it's foolish. They've exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And so, every other religion in the world, apart from biblical religion, is a result of men's rejection of God. God has revealed himself clearly, and yet they've rejected that, and they become fools, and exchange the truth about God for something else. And so whether it's a lump of wood or stone that they're bound down to, or take that, or whoever, then they have an idol. And it doesn't have to be something physical, it can be something in the mind. You talk to some people about God. I remember sitting in a Bible study one day with a girl I used to work with in a missionary organization. And we were looking at a passage in Hebrews, I forget which it was, and I made some comment, and she said, but my God's not like that. And I looked at her and I thought, well, who is your God then? Because this is the God of the Bible. So who's your God? She had a God of her own imagination. That's an idol. That's exchanging the truth about God for a lie. And this is what is commonly done up and down the country, throughout the world. The problem is, you see, men's minds are not cannot be a vacuum. If you deny God's existence, then you have to believe in something else instead, however foolish it might be. C.K. Chesterton said, probably 100 years ago, when men stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And so when you read about God being a spaceman, well, it's foolish. And it shows how wicked men's hearts are, that they will try and come up, concoct any story possible to escape God's truth. And yet that's what people do. So what does God then do? They've rejected the truth, so God then rejects them. And notice verse 24, verse 26, and verse 28. Therefore, because they've rejected God, and notice here also, no mention here about rejecting Christ. It's rejecting God that is being spoken of here. Therefore, God gave them up. Verse 26. For this reason, for the reason that they rejected God. God gave them up. Verse 28. Since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up. Now, what we're not seeing here is a downward progression. So, first of all, people drop down to verses 24 and 25, and then down to verses 26 and 27, and eventually they really hit rock bottom with verses 28 at the end of the chapter. No, this is all one thing. It's different aspects of the same thing. So, God gives people up. What's God doing? What does this mean? What's Paul saying? He's saying this. In the world, the unconverted man is being restrained by God. God has his restraining hand upon men, and he is preventing them from becoming as bad as they can possibly be. What does God do when he gives people up? He takes away his restraining hand. He says, that's the way you want to go? Then you go that way. And so we see people drifting down and down into more and more depravity as God removes restraints. And it's a dreadful thing to see. And we can see it more and more in our society. The way in which people are beginning to plumb more and more of the depths of their wicked hearts. But that's the way things are going. It's very sad indeed. But we'll just look very briefly at the ways in which these things happen. People read this and the first thing that hits them is, oh, it's all about sex. Paul had a preoccupation with sex. Well, when you read it carefully, you see that it's not preoccupied with sex. Sex is mentioned. But we find God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, the dishonouring of their bodies amongst themselves. And we see this is considered to be normal these days. That's what you find. What God says is wrong, man says is right. What man says is wrong, God says is right. So you might have heard about the big hoo-ha there's been because of what someone said on the Today program, Radio 4 last week, when they said that homosexuality was a sin and was wrong, and the Church of England should have nothing to do with it. And it's been on the front page of the paper. BBC's been inundated with letters, some approving, some complaining. People are saying, how dare she say such a thing? This is disgusting that she could say such a thing. That's what God says. And it shows the depravity of man in now saying that what was once considered wrong is now considered right. And so sexual immorality is now considered normal. Oh, you left your wife and gone off with someone else? Well, what do we expect? That's what everybody does. You mean you haven't done that? No, there must be something wrong with you. You mean you've been happily married and you've never been unfaithful? You're a really weird person. But that's the way things are going. But this is what's happening. People are becoming more and more like this because God is giving up more and more people. Verses 26 and 27. We find here a breakdown in natural relations. So instead of being immoral in a normal way, so a man and a woman having immoral sexual relationships, we now find that God has given these people up so that they abandon the opposite sex. And they go for their own sex. This is not normal. This is a result of the wrath of God being revealed in allowing people to do these things. Verse 28, we then have this list which covers just about everything else under the sun. And it's interesting to notice, Paul does not merely pick out the ones that are obvious, like murder, but we've got things in here that are not so obvious. All manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, that's internal, malice, that's internal, full of envy, that's internal, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, they are gossips. I wonder how many of the village gossips realise that they have been given up by God. Slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. And notice this, though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but approve those who practice them. These wicked people know what they're doing is wrong. They know that God has said it's wrong, but they do it in spite of that. And they encourage others to do it, because they seem to have the mentality, perhaps, well, if we get everybody doing it, then God can't judge the lot of us. They completely fail to understand God and the way God deals with the human race. Now notice, verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. How is the wrath of God revealed from heaven? Verse 24, God gave them up. Verse 26, God gave them up. Verse 28, God gave them up. So when people say, well, if God's angry with me, why doesn't he strike me down? The answer is, I can see that God's angry with you because God has given you up to do these things. So when the adulterer says, but I'm having a great time and I'm not suffering in any way, how can God be angry with me? God has revealed his anger by allowing you to become an adulterer. What do you mean God's angry with me because I'm a homosexual? You mean he's going to do to me like he did to Sodom and Gomorrah? No. God has given you up. And that's how he's revealed his anger against you, by by allowing you to become like this. These people delight in perversion, in all manner of wickedness, whatever aspect it may be, all the things that Paul lists there. But they are all the consequence of God giving people up because they have rejected God. Not because they rejected the gospel, not because they rejected Jesus Christ, because they rejected the God who has revealed himself to them. So what we find then here is that ungodliness always leads to wickedness. What you do or do not believe about God affects the way you behave. Man's answer to the problems of the human race is to deal with the symptoms. Oh dear, you're a pervert and you've got some unpleasant disease as a result. Oh well, we'll cure that. God's solution is to deal with the problem in the heart. There was a tribe, I've been told of, I don't know where it is, but I've been told there was a tribe somewhere in the middle of some jungle, and their government had given up on them. They were inbred, they were totally immoral, they were drunk most of the time, and so they were going around killing each other, and the government thought, we'll leave them. We'll forget that. No point in dealing with them. They're going to die out fairly quickly. A man went there as a missionary. He went as a medical missionary, but he was concentrating as well on preaching the gospel. So he said, here are the hours to come to see me for surgery. The rest of the time, I'm going to preach the gospel. So he looked after their ailments, sorted out all the diseases that were the result of their immorality. But along with that, he preached the gospel. People were converted. People stopped being immoral. People started to live in proper, healthy relationships. And after some period of time, the whole of society had been transformed. And they went to the government, started knocking on the door and saying, we want hospitals. We want education. Come on, it's your responsibility. And the government sat up and had to take notice. They've written them off because they were so perverted. Now, because they've been saved, God's solution had been provided, and there was this great transformation. Third thing to note, idolatry idolatry is always going to lead to immorality. That's what Paul makes clear here. By exchanging the truth about God for a lie and worshipping the creature rather than the creator, it follows on to from idolatry to immorality. And you can see this not only in the idol worshippers around the world, but you can see it also in the Western man, so-called clever person, that he is equally an idolater, just in a more subtle way, and he is just as degenerate. What you find is that the history of the human race is not one of evolution and of progress, but it's one of degeneration, going down and down. The modern view that you have is man has risen up from the apes. In fact, what is happening is that man is going back down towards the apes, in fact becoming worse than the apes in some instances. People think that man has become more and more rational. In fact, man has become more and more irrational. Instead of monotheism, belief in one God, growing out of polytheism, belief in many gods, which grew out from man being scared because he thought there were things in the trees and in the animals, it's the other way round. Man began with knowledge of the one true God and degenerated into either atheism or polytheism or whatever. Fifthly, all men have a knowledge of God without exception, internal and external. God speaks them internally and externally. All men are rational and should be able to think through these things and to come to the right conclusions. This is clear from just from that men know that there is such a thing as right and wrong, whatever they may say. But God's wrath is seen in his ceasing to restrain people from sin and allowing them the freedom to become perverts. Now, just a few closing thoughts. All the people that we read about in Romans 1 are willfully rejecting God and a true knowledge of him. There are things that people today try and avoid like the plague. One thing they try to keep out of their minds is that God is the creator. And that's why there is so much stress upon evolution. Because this is the only thing people can believe in if there's no God. So let's do away the idea of God, we'll believe in evolution instead. And the other thing I don't like to believe in is that God is going to be their judge. Once you dismiss God as being a creator, you dismiss God as being judge, and yet God is going to judge people. But they are going to stand before him. And so it's necessary that we present the truth as it's found here to people, not coming along and bludgeoning them, but sensitively recognizing that they are sinners as we are. And if it wasn't for the grace of God, we would be like the people described here. And as we read this, instead of thinking, oh, these people deserve this, we should read this and weep and think about our own hearts and think, I could have been like that. Perhaps I was once like that. And yet God has saved me from that. What a wonderful God we have. And then to look with compassion upon those around us, those who are perverts, and to think that I could have been like that. God saved me from that. God could save them from that as well. And you can go through the Acts of the Apostles and you can see how the Apostles preached and you can see how they did this. But Paul used one method because he tended to preach to pagans. The other Apostles, Peter especially, took a slightly different tack because they were dealing with Jews. And what Peter would say to Jews is, here is Jesus. You, the Jews, crucified Jesus. And the Jews would think, we know what God did in the past. We know that when we rebelled in the past, God's wrath was revealed against us. But now we've killed the Messiah, the one God promised. Now what's God going to do with us? And so we can see from this the fact that Paul begins here, the fact that Paul began there in his preaching. This is where we need to begin. No good telling people to believe in Jesus until they can see that there is a problem that requires them to believe in Jesus. So it is necessary that we begin to stress sin. We need to find ways of communicating to people their sinfulness. People won't thank you for it, unless or until they're converted. But unless they see that they're sinners, then there's going to be no hope for them. So when we're dealing with people, they're going to say things. They're going to respond to the things that we say. We have to have this in our minds to remember what they're saying isn't necessarily the truth. When they say, oh, there's no God, you know that within, God speaks to them. But as they look around, God speaks to them. And find a way of explaining to them that they know there's a God, even though they might deny it. And there are a variety of ways in which you can do that. So when people say, oh, it's dreadful what Thomas Hamilton did in Dunblane, that was disgusting. Yes, I agree, but why do you think it was disgusting? Well, those children. Well, what about when someone cuts a tree down? Is that disgusting? What about when we use fly spray and kill thousands of flies in one go? Is that disgusting? What's the difference between flies and children? Well, don't be silly, don't be stupid. But you're saying that people are important. Why are people important? Well, they are. Give us a reason. What's the difference between me and the chair? And follow this line of argument. If there's no God, all we are chemical machines. And so there's no such thing as right and wrong. All there are chemical reactions. And when we respond emotionally to something like Dunblane, chemical reactions have to work in our brain.